Hello, I'm Rick Jackson, host of The Sound of Ideas on WKSU, IdeaStream Public Media, coming to you from Cleveland in Northeast Ohio.
Hi there, I'm Ann Fisher, host of All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU, and I'm joining you from Central Ohio in Columbus.
And hey, I'm Lucy May, host of Cincinnati Edition on WVXU, part of Cincinnati Public Radio, here in Southwest Ohio.
Today, our three public media organizations are teaming up to bring you a special program as part of the Ohio Newsroom's new collaborative project called Disconnected Democracy.
We know Ohioans' views on the democratic process are polarized. So for the last few weeks, reporters across the state have sought out perspectives from everyday residents on the issues. Where is democracy working and where is it not? Where is the common ground?
This hour, we're going to look at the series as a whole, find out some lessons learned from reporters involved in the project, and highlight some of the unique voices heard during the series.
We can't take your calls today. Please send us an email with your thoughts to allsides@wosu.org.
WVXU will kick off the hour when we'll hear my conversation with people in the state who are trying to increase diverse representation in their local communities by staying civically active and preserving Black history.
Then we'll take the baton at WKSU and bring you a discussion with a Republican voter living in a blue county and a Democrat living in a predominantly red county about staying engaged when your vote counts less.
And we'll round out the show at WOSU talking to reporters from the series about lessons learned on the state of our democracy in Ohio. Lucy, take it away.
Thanks, Ann. In Washington, in our state house, and even in our communities, partisan discord is as deep as it has ever been. And it often feels like racial divides are just as intractable and challenging. But that hasn't stopped people from staying civically engaged and working to bridge the gaps. As part of the Disconnected Democracy series, freelance reporters with the Ohio Newsroom explored stories about diversity, both racial and political, in local Ohio communities. Reporter Tom Stafford talked with Lauren Kelly, a young Black woman in Springfield, leading a group called Leaders of Change, working to get more people of color into local government. And reporter Laura Harbert interviewed Dr. T. Ford Ahmed, a Black woman in Athens who is working to preserve the history of a Black church in the mostly white community, as chair of the Communications and Media Committee for the Mount Zion Baptist Church Preservation Society. Lauren Kelly and Dr. T. Ford Ahmed joined Cincinnati Edition to talk about their work and engaging their communities in these times of division. Lauren and Dr. T., welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you, Lucy.
Thank you so much for having us.
I really appreciate your being here. I wanted to start by asking you both, you know, so much of our country right now, we talk about this political divide and we talk about every issue as if it has to be political, red or blue or Democratic or Republican. Lauren, start by talking to me. Do you think issues have to be defined that way? Are there some issues that are kind of bigger than party lines or that have nothing to do with the parties?
I would definitely say there are issues that are bigger than party lines. However, at the same time, it is okay for people to think differently. It doesn't have to divide us. It doesn't have to be something where basically we have to be at odds just because we think differently. But it's okay to have a difference of opinion. It's okay to have different belief systems. We all come from different backgrounds and our foundations are different. So with that, it could be any reason that causes me to think differently than you, but it doesn't make me better. It doesn't make me less than. So I would, just to answer your question, I would say it doesn't have to be something that divides us as far as party lines, but it's okay to be different.
Mm-hmm. And you, Lauren, kind of think of yourself as a bit of a blend of different philosophies in terms of I think you described yourself as a social conservative with a deep commitment to racial equity. Do you ever feel yourself or find yourself kind of torn about which politicians best represent your views? Or do you feel like you ever have trouble fitting into the party structures?
Absolutely. Growing up, I was raised in a Republican household, and that might be a shocker, you know, considering that I'm Black, and a lot of times the idea is that the Black community leans more towards the Democratic Party. But I was raised in a Republican household, and now that I'm older and being able to come to my own conclusions, because a lot of that was influenced just, you know, by the fact that I was raised with my parents believing that way, as a young person, sometimes you don't really know what you believe. So you tend towards what your parents tell you. And then you get older and then you start to figure things out on your own. And with that, I started to realize there's flaws on both sides. Unfortunately, because of my belief system, I don't necessarily feel comfortable saying I'm one or the other. And so it does make it really hard when it comes to voting. But what I do is I vote my conscience according to my faith and what I feel God would have me do. That's what governs my vote. I don't do it based off of popularity or skin color or because someone told me I'm supposed to vote this way. I do it, however I'm feeling consciously. If this is who I feel is the best suited candidate, then that's who I vote for. But it does make it tough.
And Dr. T, how do politics fit into the work that you're trying to do with the church in Athens County? I mean, it seems like I don't know that politics is necessarily a part of it, but is there any kind of political slant to the work that you're trying to do there with the preservation of the church?
I guess in a way. However, ours is more focused toward education and educating the youth as well as the surrounding community on the gifts and a legacy that was developed in this area that has not been recognized and or that has been destroyed. And we want to bring it back to the into the fold and to the attention. So in a way, we don't really deal with the politics. However, we're in America, okay? And we know exactly that there are divisions, et cetera. But we try to, as I said, focus on this is what was happening here. We are in southeastern Ohio, which is one of the major corridors of the Underground Railroad. And there were people who stopped here because of the denseness of the trees, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. I heard our mayor say that he had one of the student pilots from Ohio University. This is the landscape here of the oldest university that was started in the southeast. In the Southeast area territory, which is Ohio University, 1804, I believe. He had one of the student pilots take him up in the air, and he said when he flew over Athens, all he could see were trees. He couldn't even see houses or anything, just trees. So we can see why the enslaved stopped here on their way to, say, Buxton, Canada, for example. It was safe. It was trees. Many of our students don't know that. And we found that out when we developed a film called Black Wall Street, Athens County, because so many of our historical structures and our history had been erased, and the wrecking ball was coming after Mount Zion, and we just rushed in and said, hold it, halt. We need to save this particular wonderful, it's a beautiful edifice also with windows that have been priced between $1 million and priceless. Mm. And so we had to make a film about that, and we showed it to the high schools and the middle schools, and one gentleman said, whoa, I had no idea that had happened in our town. So then we offered them a saving place challenge and said, okay, if there was something that you have that you would like to save, what would it be? And what would be the negative consequences of it being erased? Hmm. We had entries in that. One of our winners was a young man who did a clay model of his bedroom. And his explanation about why he did the clay model of his bedroom, he said, because in there he's a ruler, he's the king. Mm. And if that was to be erased or destroyed, it would be like tearing a limb from a tree or a limb from his body. That's what his bedroom meant to him. Mm. So our things were about saving history and teaching history. We had another young woman who drew a picture of a river in Portsmouth and a little dock by which they had set up blocks and things. And she said, that's where she and her friends meet. If that was to be destroyed by a flood or whatever, all their stories and their history would be erased and she would just sooner die. Mm. So that's what we're about, educating them to know the full story and the full history of a wonderful and part of gifts from not just one side of the political spectrum or race or ethnicity, but the entire story of everything that has been contributed to make this particular place your place and to make it whole. Mm.
And Dr. T, tell us a little bit more about the church and its significance in Athens there and its significance specifically to the Black community.
As I said, many who were on their way to freedom stopped here because of the trees, all right? Mm-hmm. And the fact that they were sheltered. But plus, there was a coal mining and a brick making industry, so some of them stopped to work. But they had to have a place together. And in 1870-some, they started to work together in a house. And eventually, a gentleman by the name of Edward Berry built a hotel. The Berry Hotel was the first 99-room place built by these people who had stopped here that was torn down. It was torn down for a parking lot. It was a 99-room hotel, the first to have Bibles, the first to have sewing kits, and was very famous. Franklin Roosevelt stopped here at this hotel. General Armstrong Custer's cook, Libby, came out of this town, etc. So it had its history. So when we saw that the land that he had given to build the church was the next thing to be destroyed, of course, we had to rush in to save that. It was a home for so many people who lived here and who lived in the surrounding areas of Chester Hill and Stewart, et cetera. This was where they all gathered. And significantly, it's at the north end of the most popular street in this college town. And they had what they called it their beacon of light. Mm. And I thought that's so revolutionary in that at the north end of Court Street is this wonderful edifice of a church that they call their beacon of light.
Well,
and they all gathered there.
Yeah, that says it all.
There. They had their weddings there. They ate there. They convened. It was everything.
Yeah.
And it became very, very popular through a choir known as the Gospel Voices of Faith. The Gospel Voices of Faith sang all over the United States. There were students from Ohio University that attended there because that was the only space that they had.
Yeah.
Let
me stop you there, Dr.
Yes.
T. I apologize. I want to get back to Lauren. We've been talking about the importance of this church and in Athens and what a critical role it has played and continues to play. Lauren, talk to us about what role your faith plays and how you approach your work in the community. It sounds like really your faith in a lot of ways is bigger than politics.
Sure. For one, my faith is what gives me purpose. So I realize that at the end of the day, politics, money, education, all of that is actually fleeting. However, it is important while we're here on earth, right? So it can go along with our purpose. God can use those things that he gives us, that he equips us with, to greater further whatever his design is and whatever his desire is for mankind. So my faith has always played a role in my life. I was raised, born and raised on the pew, I'd like to say, and being a preacher's kid. And
oh, you too?
Okay. Yes, ma'am. Yes,
all
ma'am.
Right. Hallelujah.
right. So you're speaking my language for sure. So yeah, being a preacher's kid and growing up in a household where my parents, you know, taught us about God, they didn't send us to church. They took us to church. And with that, that's all I know. However, at a certain point, you have to make a decision for yourself, in which I did at age 14. And I realized that, you know, I needed something greater, you know, trying to figure it out on my own. And you realize, okay, I can't do it on my own. And so it saved me from a lot, but that doesn't mean, you know, my life was perfect and without flaws. I've had some bumps in the road and it's taught me a lot. So when it comes to my life, when it comes to my journey, the decisions I make, even within the community, I make sure that I am very prayerful before I move forward. Because when you factor in politics, it can be a very dicey, cutthroat, divisive type of ordeal, and you really need something greater than yourself if you're going to do it. You have to really make sure, okay, this is my assignment. I'm not doing it as a job or because I've just always been interested, but rather this is really where I'm supposed to be right now in this season. So that's honestly how I live my life. I live my life according to seasons. And in this season of my life, I feel like God has had me focus on, you know, racial equality or trying to do the best that I can, as well as, you know, bringing government and the church together. You know, sometimes we look at it as separate things, but for me, that is something that actually makes me more interested in a politician or a candidate of some sort when I know that they are very grounded in their faith and they're not afraid to talk about God and they're not afraid to, you know, say, hey, I'm a Christian. That piques my interest even more. So when you can live in a community like Springfield, where I know a lot of people, I've come in contact with a lot of people who, you know, are very faith-based and they're not afraid to say it. And they work together with those in government and those who are faith-based organizations. So yes, my faith has had a lot to do with everything I do.
Well, it sounds like both of you are serving a purpose larger than yourselves, both through faith and respect for history and community. And it's been such a pleasure to talk with you both. I wish we had a lot more time. Lauren Kelly and Dr. T. Ford Ahmed, thank you so much for spending your time with us today.
Absolutely.
Thank you, my darling. It's my pleasure.
You're listening to a special broadcast for the collaborative series Disconnected Democracy, coming to you from three public radio stations in the Ohio newsroom, WKSU in Cleveland,
WOSU in Columbus,
and WVXU in Cincinnati. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to our special broadcast for the collaborative series Disconnected Democracy from the Ohio Newsroom. I'm Rick Jackson, host of WKSU's Sound of Ideas in Cleveland.
I'm Lucy May, host of WVXU's Cincinnati Edition in Cincinnati.
And I'm Ann Fisher, host of WOSU's All Sides with Ann Fisher in Columbus.
In a time of polarization, we're asking Ohioans what matters and searching for what connects us as part of the Disconnected Democracy series.
This hour, our three public radio stations have been digging deeper into some of the reporting you may have heard over the past few weeks on each of our stations.
We just heard my conversation with people in the state who are trying to increase diverse representation in their local communities. Rick, you take it from here.
When we talk about the rural America and urban American divide, we're often also talking about our politics. Residents in rural counties tend to lean conservative, while residents in urban counties tend to lean and vote more liberally. This has become even more true as our communities become more polarized. So if you're a Democrat in a red county or a Republican in a blue county, it can feel like your vote doesn't even matter. In reporter Elia Skufsky's reporting for our series Disconnected Democracy, she spoke to people who are living in communities where they are the political minority. She asked about how they stay engaged politically and whether they feel democracy is working. We've invited two of Edith's guests onto the program to discuss this further. Ed Singer is a Democrat living in a rural community in northwest Ohio, 7 miles outside Defiance, an area that's voted Republican in every presidential election since 1964. Ed, welcome to the program.
Yes, well, I'm glad to be here.
Thank you. Michelle Weiss is a Republican in University Heights, which is a large liberal suburb outside of Cleveland, where more than 70% of residents voted for President Biden. Michelle, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
You're both politically active, despite being in the political minority. Michelle, you were elected to the University Heights City Council in 2015, and in 2020, your colleagues, all Democrats, by the way, elected you to be their vice mayor. What is it like for you being in the political minority in University Heights and having this platform in the city government?
Yeah, that's actually a great question. Thank you. You know, in local politics, at least in University Heights, I feel that, you know, it should be nonpartisan. And in fact, University Heights is a nonpartisan city. Everybody on council respects each other's opinions. And that partisan, you know, kind of line never really crosses into the actual votes. You know, people care about their taxes, they care about their garbage, and they care about their safety. And between all of those global kind of issues, it's just a matter of respect. Everybody gets along well.
Taxes, garbage, and safety know no political boundaries. Thank you. Ed, you and your wife, Dorothy, also featured in Edith's story, operate a Democratic letter-writing campaign to the local paper there. Your wife co-founded the Women's Democratic Caucus of Rural Northwest Ohio. What's it like for you not having the same platform as Michelle in local government, but still having opportunities to share your thoughts on the issues?
Well, as an active citizen who tries to contribute to the community, and I think I can say that much for Dorothy as well, that... And also in the context of this polarization in a red county such as Defiance, that we talk about people living in bubbles, these kind of social enclaves where they feel comfortable. I would say that for myself, it is like living in a bubble that is not of my choosing and certainly not of my own making. You mentioned the letters to the editor, the writers' committee that I coordinate. We have writers who write back. Our policy is to focus on policies and never attack persons. But when we put our letters in, we try not to provoke. But what comes back at us is often some very angry letters. And also, we also receive mail from angry people who read the opinion page. And occasionally, those letters are threatening. I have been attacked in a letter through the U.S. mail by someone who says they're determined to destroy my reputation, whatever that reputation is. I don't know. And someone else on our committee just very recently received a letter that her children felt that they needed to take it to the police.
Has it always been this way, or has it gotten worse recently?
Well, I've only been politically active to the extent that I am now since 2016, and you know, watching things during the 8 years of Obama, I do feel like things got much more polarized. And then, of course, going into the 4 years of Trump.
Michelle, he unpacked a lot there. I know that you were a President Trump supporter. Do you see the same thing, that the anger has ratcheted up? And do you feel living in a more liberal community has, you know, impacted how you do things?
So, again, you know, our city is nonpartisan. I try to, even as the vice mayor, keep everything on track where they don't hit that national type of rhetoric. In terms of, you know, I sympathize with you know, my colleague on the line in terms of, I think that's awful. I mentioned to Ida, and I'll mention it now, that you need to get people around the table to talk, because I believe you do have, on the right and on the left, you know, fringes, but most of the people, I have a lot of friends that are Democrats, are moderate. And every person that I know, and, you know, include as a friend and a colleague, want to come in the middle and compromise. That's the only way that you can get anything done, not just in the city, but in this country. And some people are on both sides not willing to do that, and that's unfortunate, you know, in our country right now, and we need to get back to a place where we can do that.
Have you ever had the kinds of letters or responses Ed Singer was describing that he gets in Defiance?
Social media has its opportunities and challenges, and it's very interesting, because I think when somebody can hide behind their name and not face somebody, they feel that they have more freedom to express anger and resentment, and something they would never express in person. So directed to me, I have had that, not to the extent, you know, as it, I guess, in Defiance is happening. But there's also been some letters that have been sent that I did also report to the police. It's not necessarily a partisan kind of thing, but if somebody just disagrees with you, I think, in general.
Ed, we know that you're also a retired professor. You've got a PhD in rural sociology. Does any of that help you to better understand that community where you've chosen to reside?
Yeah, that's a good question. Part of the reason it's a good question is because I'm not sure. It's a very difficult reality, and it's complex here. I wouldn't say that it necessarily, you know, causes me to have some insight that other people couldn't have. But I will say that the discipline and my training helps me to focus on and look for the kinds of social structures and processes that lead us to behave as individuals the way we do, and also to understand perhaps the difficulty it is for us, whether we are Republican or Democrat, to deal with the polarization that we have here. And I say that carefully because I do not think the polarization is our fault. And when I say our, I mean the entire community of Defiance County. Whether you are putting a Trump sign up or if you are a Democrat, I put the fault on the leadership. It's one thing to lie and not have any power at all. It's another thing to hold a lot of power and be a leader with a great deal of responsibility and lie and spread those lies that divide us and bring into question one of the most effective institutions in our democracy, which is the electoral system.
Thanks, Ed. Michelle, I know that your local politics, it's not always about some of the big issues that he brought in, but is that the kind of thing that you frequently hear and it does enter into chambers?
No, I mean, we are dealing with local politics. And again, you know, I really do want to stress that it's nonpartisan and we try to keep it even keel like that. You know, local politics, in my opinion, actually make huge differences. It starts with local government. It goes up to in Ohio and to Columbus. And that's what really kind of shapes each state and each city. So, you know, this conversation, you know, is revolving more, you know, about the small towns and the cities as opposed to the global partisan politics here. If something does enter the arena, I can say in University Heights, at least, that our council, again, and I mentioned this before, agrees to disagree. And we do it respectfully. And I do agree that the national tone is not that anymore, and it needs to get back to that.
Thanks. What do you say, Michelle, when you hear friends or family say, and I quoted that figure earlier, 70% of your town voting for Joe Biden. What do you say to family when they say, why do you even bother vote? You know it's not going to count.
So, you know, I actually feel that every vote does count. And I consistently and constantly say that. We just had an election, you know, a couple days ago. And there were many, many issues that won by 10 votes. A couple years ago, we had a mayor that was elected by less than 50 votes. Every single vote counts. Listen, obviously, when you're getting to these national numbers, hundreds of thousands, millions of votes, it's a difference. But when you get to state and local politics, every single vote does count.
Ed, what about you when people say, oh, look where you live, a Democratic vote doesn't count? How do you respond?
You know, with the gerrymandering, I can't disagree with Michelle that every vote counts. But with the gerrymandering, some votes count more than others. And so, you know, and that's what we're fighting right now at the state level. But back to an earlier point about politics, local politics versus state and federal. And I think that we have a problem in Defiance County, and this may be the case for other rural counties, of something that probably you're both familiar with, which is, I think, referred to in the literature as the nationalization of politics, where there's less and less of a separation between what goes on at the national level and what goes on at the local level.
Finally, Michelle, he mentioned earlier the idea of respect, and you said in your council there is respect amongst the members. Do you think, though, as a nation, as a county, as a city, we've lost any part of democracy where we do respect each other's differences?
Yeah, I think we've completely lost it, actually. You know, it's funny, in Defiance, the same thing happens in Cuyahoga County. A Republican cannot win county council in in Cuyahoga County. We have lost that respect for each other. We definitely have. You know, you can go back 50 years and Congress looked wholly different. There was a certain, even when you look at the Supreme Court hearings, right? This is the dialogues that are going on now, and the narrative that have been put out there was never the case 50 years ago. You know, a lot of things actually I just have read recently have been written up about that. We need to get back to agreeing to disagreeing. Nobody is ever going to agree with you on each party 100%, but you could do it respectfully, and you can do it with the greater good in common. You know, I've mentioned in the past, I think I even mentioned it to Ida, you know, there are some things that I agree, you know, that Democrats are proposing, and I think they're great, but it's not one or the other. There's always a need to compromise and collaborate. People forget that they are working for their constituents. They're not, you know, and what they're forgetting is they just want to move up to the next ring in the ladder. It has to come back down, and people need to be grounded.
Ed Singer, Michelle Weiss, thank you so much for your candor today, and thank you for joining us for this conversation.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
It's been my pleasure.
You're listening to a special broadcast for the collaborative series Disconnected Democracy, coming to you from three public media stations in the Ohio newsroom: WKSU in Cleveland,
WOSU in Columbus,
and WVXU in Cincinnati. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to our special broadcast for the collaborative series Disconnected Democracy from the Ohio Newsroom. I'm Ann Fisher, host of WOSU's All Sides with Ann Fisher in Columbus.
I'm Rick Jackson, host of WKSU's The Sound of Ideas in Cleveland.
And I'm Lucy May, host of WVXU's Cincinnati Edition in Cincinnati. This hour, our three public media stations have come together to take a deeper look at the political issues that matter to Ohioans as the country becomes increasingly polarized.
The Disconnected Democracy series asks, where is democracy working and where it isn't in the state? You may have heard some of the stories from the series on our stations over the past few weeks. We just heard my conversation with two voters about how to stay engaged when your county tends to vote differently than you do. And take it from here.
Everyday Ohioans are feeling the rub of political polarization. Teachers in the classroom, small business owners just trying to make a living during a pandemic amid public health protocols, and voters at the ballot box. On one hand, elected officials seem to have the power to legislate without representation in a system stymied by gerrymandered districts and within a paradigm of politics that rewards the wealthy and influential. In this segment of Disconnected Democracy, we hear about the struggles from Shay Frank of WYSO in Yellow Springs. Shay, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And WOSU reporter Renee Fox will talk about how public policy plays out when it comes to raising taxes to pay those bills and how state lawmakers control where the funding flows. Renee also reported on a strategy to change how elected officials talk to their constituents, all of them. Renee Fox, welcome.
Hi, Ann. Thank you.
Shay, let's start with you. Bills debating how teachers can or cannot address race, sex, and other content considered divisive or age inappropriate have been part of the polarization taking place in Ohio's public education system. Tell me about the teacher that you spoke with and shared their thoughts.
Yeah, so I spoke with Dan Greenberg. He's an English teacher at Southview High School, and that's in Sylvania, Ohio. He's also the president of the Sylvania Education Association, so he knows a lot about the laws, and he talks to a lot of people on the board about what's going on for Sylvania schools. He was a really great guy. He was super, just very excited about talking about what needs to be done for public education, rather than what's currently being done. So he believes that what should be done is there should be a bolstering of funding and people should back teachers more rather than demonize them as they have been recently.
What did he say were his biggest concerns?
So he's saying his biggest concerns have mostly been the issue with funding for public education, and then also the deprofessionalization of educators in Ohio, to the point of people have been even saying that they're using students, indoctrinating them, whereas he believes they're really just doing their job, which is teaching them to be a part of our democracy.
And did he talk about teachers wanting to leave the profession because of this?
Yeah, he said that he has had some, heard some things about teachers leaving, partially because of teacher evaluations, which are too harsh. Also, he has heard of teachers deciding not to become teachers after college or after further education because of their fears for these new laws and things keeping them from teaching certain things that they believe need to be taught in schools.
I thought it was interesting in the final analysis, he said he still loves to teach, and that's where he kind of gets his yayas from, right?
Yes, he told me it's his favorite thing is working with these kids and seeing where they turn out, you know, where they end up being, how successful they are. And it's all because he thinks that public education is the root of our democracy.
Shay, the pandemic was tough on small business owners whose decisions about how to manage the challenges often took on political overtones. Tell us who you spoke with for your story on that topic.
Yeah, so I spoke with two different small businesses in Toledo. The first was Culture Clash. The owner, Tim Friedman, and I spoke in his big stage area. It was really interesting to see that area. And then I also spoke with Paulette Ciccone from Paulette Studio of Dance. Both of them had some very different reactions to safety measures during COVID.
Tell me, what does Culture Clash do? What's the business for?
Yeah, so Culture Clash is a record store. It's in the city, so it's pretty popular amongst people who live in the city. So for him, he did say that he did not experience as much backlash for his COVID safety measures because most people were already willing to do the curbside and willing to do online shopping as well.
So what were their challenges then when it came to the pandemic?
Right. So for Tim specifically, he said it was difficult trying to balance satisfying the public and keeping him and his employees and the public safe. He said he got a few bad reviews or people, you know, voicing their opinions about him using masks for longer than most places in Toledo. But in the end, he says he feels like he had an overwhelming support from the city. Mostly people came out the way they could. You know, they shopped online. They did curbside pickup. They wore the masks that were asked to be worn. So yeah, those were some of his struggles initially. We're seeing the reactions of the public to his safety measures.
And the performance venue?
Yeah, so it's connected to a stage. So it's a slightly larger building. There's one side of the store, which is all the records and like merchandise, things like that. And then the other side was an open stage venue, which he uses for events like Record Store Day, which happened in April.
That probably changed a lot.
Yes, he said that they didn't actually have any music or any performances on that stage for a couple of years, mostly because of the issues of, is it safe? Can people catch this virus if they come to the show even with a mask? So up until the end of this April, he'd pretty much not been using that stage.
Renee, you reported about the increasing frequency of unopposed candidates on Ohio ballots. You talked about the role of gerrymandering and all of that. What's the connection?
Well, as districts become more gerrymandered, there's less and less competition in general elections. So because the districts are designed to be less competitive, they're designed to go toward a Democrat or a Republican. And what that ends up doing is pushing all of the competition in an election into the primary, which can really force people to the right or to the left further than they might be if they were in a more competitive district.
That's because they're trying to appeal to that base.
Yeah, they want to appeal to their base, and because that's who primarily comes out in a primary. You're getting the diehard Republicans, the diehard Democrats coming to support someone who might be more left or more right than most of the general population.
And what do we know about what that does to voter turnout, knowing that no matter whether they turn out or not in particular districts, their vote won't count?
Right. Well, it has an effect during their whole entire election because uncontested races won't get as much coverage from the news. You won't hear about it in your newspaper or on NPR as often. So what happens is people become less engaged with the political system overall and tend to either wait it out or watch from the sidelines with disgust or maybe only come out for the really big elections instead of the smaller ones that can have more of an impact on their day-to-day lives.
We were talking earlier about funding for education, and that's not part of the local government fund, but the local government fund is really important to local municipalities and smaller governments across the state. You reported about that. What's happened to the local government fund over the last 15 or so years?
Well, with the local government fund cuts, the state dropped the percentage of their general fund revenue that they share with local governments like cities, villages, townships, counties. It used to be around 4.2% at its height, and it was whittled down to a little more than 1.5% in recent years, and it's kind of stuck there. Advocates want to see that go up to at least 3.68% of the state's total budget. But combined with those cuts to the local government fund and other cuts to income taxes, the estate tax, there's about $1 billion in revenue a year that local governments are missing out on that they used to receive from the state.
What would they spend that money on?
Oh, that would be money that they could spend on a lot of different things. It wasn't just tied to a road or a police department. If maybe you wanted to upgrade your bathrooms so that handicapped people can access it, then that money could go toward that. Or it could go to buy a new dump truck or salt for the roads, that type of thing.
So what are local communities doing now that the local government fund has dried up so much?
Well, most of them have turned to raising local taxes in other ways.
So the taxpayer's paying one way or the other.
Yes. It's just a less predictable and less consistent tax rate between cities and rural areas and things like that. So you might see property taxes go up in one place, or you might see a sales tax go up.
People might have noticed there are increasingly more library levies on the ballot.
Yeah, there were cuts to library funds, even though Ohio had historically a really well-funded library system. There have been cuts to that recently.
Interestingly, concurrently through over these last 15 years, the Ohio General Assembly also has been cutting taxes,
yes.
Cutting tax rates. What's been the outcome of that at this point?
Well, those tax cuts were cut to the income tax, and that affected high earners, mostly people making $500,000 a year or more. So that's gone to
paying less tax now.
Paying less taxes than they were before. So that shift has created more of a reliance on regressive taxes like the sales tax and property taxes instead of a progressive tax, which the income tax is, because
the more you make, the more you pay.
Exactly.
And regressive, no matter how much you make, you're still paying the same amount at the gas pump, for example.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So those go up, and that puts a harder strain on lower income people and provides less money overall for services.
Most of these cuts have taken place during when Republicans have controlled the Ohio General Assembly. How do they defend these tax cuts? Why do they say this is a good idea?
Well, many will tell you that creating the best business environment possible in Ohio includes lower income taxes and a slate of other incentives for businesses. But the belief is that if these taxes are cut, Ohio becomes a more business-friendly state, and Ohio can attract more business, more jobs, and that will lift up the entire state is the idea. Now, some will tell you that we've experienced it for the last decade or two, and we aren't really seeing that change. We aren't seeing Ohio's performance numbers increase.
Now there's efforts afoot to abolish the income tax in Ohio, right?
Yes, yeah. That's I believe a bill was introduced last month.
Altogether, but without a strategy for replacing the lost revenue.
Right. And I think when we saw that happen in Kansas, they had to revert and bring the income tax back, didn't they?
Yeah, well, yes. that would be a fun thing. You know, throughout this hour, we've addressed how our electoral system is becoming more polarized and concerns some have about the future of democracy. Renee Fox, you reported on a new concept called deliberative town halls. This is just sort of a theory, right?
Yeah, well, it's a theory that's being put into practice by Ohio State University's Michael Neblo and the IDEA Institute. It's the Institute for Democratic Engagement and Accountability at OSU. And this model, the Institute has been practicing with members of Congress, and they're having some success. They're called deliberative town halls. And instead of just a normal town hall where the politician reaches out, puts out the message, and usually it's most of his or her supporters that come, or maybe a couple of people who really don't like this congressperson, they'll show up and...
Again, that polarization.
Yeah, they'll come and they'll argue, or they'll come and clap at the talking points, and it's not really a productive meeting, although it does give people a chance to raise issues to the congressperson. But these deliberative town halls are different in that they kind of curate a audience based on random sampling. So the politicians are hearing from the actual constituents, not just their supporters or their detractors.
And is it moderated in a way that they're not just hearing from them, but there's some give and take or some back and forth?
Yeah, there's moderating that the Institute does. The questions are submitted beforehand, and they make sure that there's nothing inappropriate in it. And then they kind of help the politician go back and forth with the constituents based on facts and how they think things should be done.
Is this something that really just works in a small town environment, or they think they can scale it up to a larger city like Columbus?
What they're finding is actually that it's easier to do in a larger area because it's easier to get a random sampling of people. And that's when you really see the progress, is when you have the random sampling. So actually, the smaller you go, the harder it is to get that true random sampling.
And the challenges is getting the sampling proper?
Yeah. They want to make sure they're not just getting conservatives or just getting liberals. Like, they want a true mix, and people who might be more in the middle or who maybe don't even usually participate in politics.
And what is their expectation that elected officials are going to want to participate with the constituency in this way?
Well, Neblo says that politicians are hungry for a better way of doing things, that they don't really want to have, not all of them, don't want to have this polarized, nonsensical discourse. They want to really engage and learn. But, you know, about 50 members of Congress have participated, so not all of them by any means. But the model, they're trying it out in Australia and in London, too. So there is interest, but it probably... It probably won't be your next town hall meeting unless some of these principles are practiced by the organizers.
Well, Renee Fox and Shay Frank, I want to thank you both for joining me today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Anne.
Thank you.
Please send us an email with your thoughts to allsides@wosu.org.
That's it for our show today. I'm Rick Jackson. You can follow The Sound of Ideas on Twitter. We're at Sound of Ideas.
And I'm Ann Fisher. You can follow our All Sides team on Twitter at WOSU All Sides.
And I'm Lucy May. You can follow Cincinnati Edition on Twitter at 917WVXU.
Before we go, we mentioned a lot of the good work from our reporters for the Disconnected Democracy series, but we'd like to thank our editors as well, including Steve Brown, ML Schultze, Andrew Meyer, and Annie Wu.
Thanks, everybody. This was a lot of fun. We should do it again sometime.
Yes, let's.
See you next time.